this thing up close.
Can you hear in the back?
Yeah.
Okay. Please, if I move away, raise your hand so I know to do better. I'm also told that there's a loop in this room, so those of us with hearing aids can presumably switch to the T position, I think, and that should work, and I'd be curious about whether it does or not. The second housekeeping detail is I always worry about how much material I've got, and so I'm afraid of being embarrassed by it'll be 25 minutes past the hour and I'm done. So I prepare far too much material, and then because I want to say it all, I go like hell. So that's also a problem. Where there's a real university course with an exam at the end, I would not do that. I always think one should sacrifice the amount of quantity for depth of penetration, but that doesn't matter so much here, I hope. And if anybody likes, I can put all these words I've written up on the web at the end of the week, and then, or whenever my son gets around to it, what I depend upon for such details. Anyway, let's get started. I promised to talk about calendars yesterday, and I want to do that today. The first calendars, and the easiest calendars to make, are, of course, lunar calendars, because we see the moon virtually every night. And as long ago as at least 2,000 years ago, 2,000 BCE, so 4,000 years ago, the Babylonians have recorded lots of information about the motion of the moon and based calendars on that. And there are four, at least, different lunar months. Okay, and this is one, and there are lots of problems with this. First of all, the standard definition of the lunar month is this one called the synodic month. And that's when the moon goes from, say, full back to full. It's from phase to the same phase a month later. Notice it's 29.5306 days. We know that number to six significant figures. The Babylonians knew it to four, 29.53. I mean, these are astonishing observations to me. There is also a sidereal lunar month. Now, if you point a stick at the sky and it is fixed on a given star on a given night, and you wait a month for the moon to come back to that particular star, that's a sidereal month, a stellar month. And that's only 27.32 days. But that's not all, because the plane of the moon's orbit is tilted with respect to the ecliptic, as I see here, by about 5 degrees. And it is an elliptical orbit. And notice it crosses the ecliptic at only two points. Okay. And these points are called nodes and are very important because they are the only times when the sun, the earth, and the moon are in a straight line, and therefore you could possibly have an eclipse. Can only occur at these nodal points. And the time to go from one node back to another node is called the draconian month. And that, you notice, is 27.21 days, a little bit less than the sidereal month. Now, we'll have a fourth definition, excuse me, because the moons, if I draw the major axis of this ellipse, that's called the line of apsides, a term I will use on occasion. If I draw that line, the moon does not repeat this orbit every time because the Earth is not the only object exerting a significant gravitational pull. The sun, far away but huge, exerts a serious pull on the moon's motion, and so this line, this major axis, this apsidal line for the ellipse, changes slightly in direction. That is, it makes a big circle over time. That's called precession. It moves around, And that takes about 9 years. However, when the moon goes around in a month, by the time it comes back here to this top point's no longer there. It's moved over a little bit because the line has rotated a tiny amount each month. And therefore, the time to go from the top of an orbit back to the top of an orbit is also, that's called an anomalistic month, and that's 27.55 days. There are other definitions. This is a complicated business. And there will be a lot of numbers in this discussion. Now, the fact that people 3,000 and 4,000 years ago could do this, just I find really astonishing. Ancient calendars were generally based either on the synodic month or on the solar month or in some combination of the two. Now, the 12 lunar months, synodic lunar months, are 354 days, which is 11 days short of 365. There are lots of calendars in the world still today, the Hebrew calendar and the Islamic calendar, both of which are lunar calendars, and they are, in some sense, aware of this 11-day difference. Now, in order, because what the Hebrew calendar does is it adds, when necessary, and we'll see how when that is, it adds an entire leap month so that a lunar year has 13 months on occasion, not 12. The Islamic, and that keeps things in sync. The Islamic calendar does not do that, which is why we see festivals like Ramadan moving throughout the year. Sometimes it's in the summer, sometimes it's in the winter. Because of this 11-day shortfall problem, attempts were made to find some period of time which would sync these two lunar and solar definitions in the calendar together. And so what people looked for was a period under which the number of lunar months was an integral number and the number of solar months was an integral number, obviously not the same integral number, but still. And that turns out to be possible, and it occurs every 19 years. Okay? Every 19 years, which is 228 solar months, 19 times 12, is also 235 lunar months. And there's a 7-month difference between those two things. Notice, by the way, that 19 years is 19 is a prime number. Prime numbers, of course, are numbers which are only divisible by one and by themselves, not by any other number. And the appearance of prime numbers in this calendar business is truly remarkable, and we'll come back over and over. The Hebrew calendar is very aware of this difference and therefore adds 7 months every 19 years, that is 7 leap months every 19 years in order to keep the calendars in sync. And that's done because the festival of Passover has to occur on the first full moon after the vernal equinox. And if the vernal equinox occurs in November, you have a hard time. Now, the synodic month of 29.53 days, 235 lunar months, have in them 125 months, 235 months, I just wrote this because I find all these numbers confusing, is 125 months of 30 days and 110 months of 29 days. And that gives us 125 times 30 and 110 plus 29. That means this cycle is 6,940 days long, and it's called the Metonic cycle in honor of the Greek philosopher and astronomer Meton, who lived 500 BCE. So 2,500 years ago, people counted the month 6,940 days. That's quite remarkable. Now, Notice we have 7 leap months, that is 7 13-month years, in a 19-year cycle. Again, 7, 13, 19, all prime numbers. Very strange business, and will make a problem. Now, even this is wrong, okay, because almost everything in measuring time is difficult. And so about a century later, it was noticed by Calypsos that the metonic cycle is 1/76th of a day too long, 400 BC. So every 76 years, 4 times 19, we have to subtract one day in order to keep things in sync. So we have a calypsic cycle, which is 4 times 6,940 days minus a day, or 27,759 days long, in which the solar calendar and the lunar calendar come back into sync. Astonishing stuff. Now, the Greek word for conjunction has given us an English word called syzygy, which I had never heard of until this business, and that's spelled S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y. It's the only word I know of that has 3 Y's in it, and it's a lovely word. And it is a collective noun for the appearance of either a new moon or a full moon. Okay. Now, an eclipse can only take place at a nodal point, that is when the sun, the moon, and the earth are in a straight line. And a lunar eclipse always occurs when the moon is at full, and a solar eclipse always occurs when the moon is new, so at a syzygy. So we can only have eclipses at a conjunction or a syzygy. At the same time, we have a nodal point, and that is the sidereal month. Whoops, there's a picture of a lunar eclipse. So the sidereal month and the draconian month have to have an integral number of sidereal months with an integral number of draconian months. Not a terribly important thing to worry about, but here are pictures of eclipses, and we can see the moon is full, and it lies in the shadow, or umbra, to use the Latin word, and these three things have to be in a straight line. It's red, and it is red, because the Earth has an atmosphere, of course, and this atmosphere bends light around corners, and the red light bends more than any other color of light, and so the moon appears sort of a dirty, rusty red. A solar eclipse occurs at a new moon, as we can see here. There's the bright side, there's the dark side. And you notice, unlike a lunar eclipse, it's only visible at a certain place on Earth. This looks like about Hawaii here, that being South America. Now, this occurs, an integer number of sidereal and draconian months, every 223 months. A little over 18 years, 18 solar months, 18 years and 7 months. And that's also, 223 is also a prime number, although it's very hard to tell that. You have to keep trying to divide by 2, by 3, by 4. Nothing works. This 223 months, the Greeks also knew, the Babylonians also knew, it's called a Saros cycle. And this will all come back to us. Now, it enabled the Greeks to predict the eclipses, which Hipparchus, about 150 BCE, was able to do. In 1900 sometime, a Roman wreck, a galley, was discovered on the ocean floor, the Mediterranean floor, near the tiny Greek island of Antikythera, which is in between the Peloponnese and the island of Crete. This was the first maritime wreck ever discovered, and was the first of about 1,000 now that have been discovered. And on that wreck were numerous statues in bronze and in marble, but also a bunch of bronze encrusted things that look like that. A whole lot of them, as you can see. And it has taken about a century to figure out what these are. You can see that there are wheels, and if we could see closely enough, we could see that these wheels have gear teeth on them. And this has been very carefully dated to sometime between 70 and 80 BCE. Okay. Now, before this, this is, as I said, taken about a century to decode, and it was published in various journals, Nature and other science journals, from about 2006, 2008, and so forth, and is the most remarkable thing. First of all, gear teeth from about 80 BC. Okay, before this discovery, the earliest geared mechanism we knew of was about 700 or 800 of this common era. So we've now moved 800 or 900 years earlier in the history of technology, and the first use of some fancy things like epicyclic gearing, which was also used on this device, did not occur until the Renaissance and the invention of clocks. So this is a truly remarkable device, and had we six lectures, I would give you a whole hour on just this so-called Antikythera mechanism, but we don't. Nonetheless, I've been asked to give a talk on that at the Grahamstown Science Festival in mid-March sometime, so if anybody happens to be in Grahamstown at that time, you're obviously welcome to come. What is this machine? Well, this machine is a 2,000-year-old computer. It's not a digital computer like the machine uses. That is, it's not electronic, but it is an analog computer. It's a mechanical computer, and here's what it looks like, or looked like, 2,000 years ago. This is a reconstruction of it. Dials, gears. This represents the sun. There you can see is the moon and the phases of the moon. This thing is a computer, and it calculates the position of all the known planets, the five known planets at that time, the position of the sun and the moon at any time in the past, at any time in the future. It will tell you when eclipses are due to occur, and also if it's how long the eclipse will last. And if it's a solar eclipse, whether it's a total eclipse or a so-called annular eclipse, where the moon only blocks out the center of the sun and there's a lit ring around, and that occurs because the moon is often at different distances from the Earth because of the elliptical orbit. It has an enormous number of gears, and it has gears with prime numbers, 19 teeth, 223 teeth, etc. And one of the people who worked on this model said it took him with a hammer and chisel and a file about a half an hour to take and make a small gear. So it was pretty quick. But the idea of dividing a circle into 19 parts really stymies me. I can divide it into 18 parts or 20 parts, but an odd number is really quite an achievement, it seems to me. One of these gears has 223 teeth in it to represent the Saros cycle. Who in the world made this thing? Well, careful investigations have shown that this is a Corinthian Greek device, and almost certainly was made by a disciple of Archimedes, who lived in the Corinthian colony of Syracuse on the island of Sicily. That is, although Archimedes died in 212 BCE, and this is from about 70 or 80, he had a workshop. Look at all these tiny little gear teeth down here. I really like that because Archimedes is one of my great heroes in the world and considered one of the three significant seminal thinkers in physics, along with Isaac Newton and Albert Einstein. Now, we really need to get on to talking about planets. And the word planet is also Greek. It comes from the Greek word wanderer or planetos. And it's true, it's called wanderer because their motion as viewed from Earth, especially the outer planets, Mercury, Jupiter, and Saturn, have a very peculiar motion across the star, the sky. If you look at Mars and you take a picture of Mars in the sky at every night over a long period of time, this is Archimedes. Was the defender of Syracuse against the Roman invasion, and he succeeded. The Romans tried to invade by boat because it's a port, and he succeeded in driving them off by incredible machines such as a huge claw that could come down from the battlements and lift the ship out of the water, scaring the hell out of the sailors, of course. But eventually a traitor showed the Romans how to get through a pass over the mountains, and they came in. The Roman general Marcellus said, "Don't kill this old man," but not all soldiers pay attention, and so some young buck came over with his spear and his sword and found an old man sitting on the beach making circles in the sand, and he walked on them, and the old man said, "Mimotus kiklos taratento, mess with my circles," at which the young soldier killed him. Kiklos, the word up here, is where we get our word circle from. There's a picture of Mars as viewed every night at the same time. Notice it moves in one direction here and then changes, turns around and moves in the other direction for a while and then changes again and moves back here. That's why it's called the wandering star. Of course, it's not a star, but it's a planet. This kind of reversal of motion is called retrograde motion, and it's something we need to talk about. All the planets behave somewhat like the sun. That is, the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, and all planets move across the sky from east to west every night in exactly the same fashion. And this is, of course, due to the Earth's rotation about its axis from west to east. It's not real. However, if you look at the planets every night and you take a picture, you can see this with the moon as well, it moves every evening more and more to the east, slowly to the east. And the moon moves to the east in a regular fashion, and anybody who lives here and has ever been up on Lion's Head at full moon knows the moon lies to the east, and it's really quite an incredible sight. But every once in a while, these planets will stop moving to the east, turn around, move to the west, stop again, turn around, and move to the east. This is much easier to understand this based on a heliocentric model rather than on a geocentric model, because on our present model, what we see is, of course, the Earth being behind Mars in its orbit, but then as we move, it catches Mars and passes Mars, and this changes where Mars appears in the sky. It's quite easy, by the way, to distinguish a planet from a star, because stars twinkle, planets do not. I was once walking across a university campus following a young couple who were holding hands and stopping every once in a while for necking and so forth. It was very pleasant. It was a lovely evening, and the girl looked at the boy sort of sheepishly and said, "You know, I've got all these wishes, and I keep wishing on that star up there, and it never comes true." And I couldn't help myself, but I said, "You know, that's because you're wishing on a planet and it's not a star." So I'm afraid I disturbed the mood. But Planets don't shine by themselves. They reflect light from the sun. Stars are incredibly bright. They're as bright as the sun, if not brighter, but they're so far away that the amount of light getting to Earth is very small, much smaller than the amount of light from the, that's reflected from the surface of planets. Excuse me. And so that sometimes the Earth's atmosphere changes in the temperature or winds or so forth will deflect the light from a straight line, and therefore it will blink out for a small period of time, what we call twinkling. To the Greeks, there were seven planets in the sky. There's the five we know of: Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. Plus, also for them, of course, the Moon and the Sun were planets. Because the Moon is closest to the Earth and moves most rapidly and is biggest in the sky, it was considered to be closest. And no other planets were known until the discovery of the telescope in 1607, and even then, not until 1781, when William Herschel in England discovered the planet Uranus. Herschel, by the way, was the father of John Herschel, who came to South Africa and established an observatory in the Cape region, not far from here. The retrograde motion takes place on a very regular basis, every 116 days for Mercury, 584 days for Venus, 780, 399, and 378 days for Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. The Greeks could divide these five planets into two separate groups because Mercury and Venus never get very far from the Sun. Mercury never more than about 28 degrees, and Mars never more than about, I'm sorry, Venus never more than about 45 degrees. Venus, of course, is what we call the evening star, or sometimes the morning star, again a misappellation because it's not a star, but it took millennia before people realized that it was the same object in the morning and in the evening. And its motion across the sky, its retrograde motion, looks like that. You can see it changing direction and coming back again. There was a transit of the planet Venus in June of last year across the face of the Sun. It moved across the face of the Sun. It doesn't do that every year because the orbit is slightly tilted relative to the ecliptic. And the next transit, transits are important because they allow us to calculate the distance to the Sun. The next one won't be until the year 2117. That's a very long time from now. When planets are on the far side of the Sun, that is, when you've got planet, Sun, Earth, that's called conjunction. And when you've got Sun, Earth, planet, like that, that's called opposition. And we can see here that retrogression only occurs in opposition when the Earth is in between those two things, never when the planet is over on that side and the Earth is still over on that side. Observations of the Sun and the Moon were crucial for calendar calculations. Observations of planets were less important, but even so, we've got records from Babylonia that are from 2000 BCE of this retrogressive motion. People knew. Now, when there was Museum of Alexandria was founded, there was an enormous amount of data coming from those, from them, and as I've said yesterday, people were really only interested in being able to calculate, in doing mathematics with these things, not in what was really going on in the heavens. And so, even though the calendar problem had been solved by people like Meton and Kalypsos, the first attempts to understand planetary motion involved adding a circle to the circular motion, which we have come to call epicycles. So here's a picture of what people originally did. First of all, we had the Earth at the center, and then the planet moving around on a circle called a deferent. Okay? Now, this doesn't account for retrograde motion at all. And so to account for the retrograde motion, an epicycle like this was added, so that the planet actually rode on a circle centered on the deferent. And here's what such a thing looks like from the Earth. And you can see that we would get this circle and that circle give you, we would get retrograde motion. But even that was not good enough and to really describe what was going on. And so what happened eventually was the Earth was moved away from the center, a distance called an equant. And then there was an arbitrary point put on the other side of the center of the deferent, also at the distance of the equant. And the center of the deferent circle then had to rotate about this equant point. Well, this is an astoundingly complicated calculation, and just the fact that these guys were capable of doing it. This is useful for Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. This distance here was very useful for describing Venus and Mercury, but it's all madness. I mean, it has no relation to reality. It's just a calculational tool. Okay. Now, the model gives this crazy model gives a good fit to the data, but it's, you know, as I say, it's madness. Now, there's another thing going on, and that is if you are in the northern hemisphere and you look up at the stars at night, the axis of the Earth points at the star Polaris, the so-called North Star, and that's north. In the same way that the Southern Cross points to the southern pole of the sun. But that isn't always true. The axis of the Earth rotates very slowly, precesses, it's called precession. It rotates very slowly. It takes 26,000 years to make a circle. The Greeks knew this was true. Hipparchus knew this about 150 BCE. How they managed to do that, I've not been able to discover. I think I know how, but it's very tricky. This is called the precession of the equinoxes. And here's an example, because we know that if anybody's ever played with a top, or had a grandchild that played with a top, knows that if you have a top and the center of mass is not directly over the support point, this will not only rotate like crazy, but it'll precess slowly. And that's what happens. There's the Earth's axis, and it also precesses slowly in 26,000 years. And it's due to the fact that the Sun is not the only object pulling on the Earth significantly, but so is the planet Jupiter. Jupiter is very big. Were it a little bit bigger, it would have been a star. And were it a star, we wouldn't be here. So it's very fortunate that all it does is make this thing precess. Now, now I want to come to the culmination of Greek astronomy in terms of Claudius Ptolemy. I want to distinguish two periods in Greek thought. There is, and the key is Alexander the Great, because before Alexander we have what's called the Hellenic period. Greece dominated the Mediterranean. But after Alexander conquered most of the world, or at least most of what was then considered to be the world, we enter what's called a Hellenistic period, as opposed to a Hellenic. And then work is done throughout Asia Minor and North Africa. And the giants of the Hellenistic period are Hipparchus and Ptolemy from our point of view. But they were not interested in cosmological questions. They were interested in astronomical, mathematical questions. and so they just calculated. The Ptolemy's epicycles really are just a reflection of the Earth's rotation about the Sun. He had extraordinary data, of course, from Alexandria, and any modern historian or astronomer must wonder why he did not just put the Sun at the center. But of course, that's very anachronistic thinking, and as I mentioned yesterday, we have to look with less knowledgeable eyes. Nonetheless, Ptolemy's system was the beginning and the end of astronomy for something like 1,200 years, over 1,200 years. He was the alpha and omega of astronomical thought. We don't really know when he lived, but we have recorded observations from him in 127 of this era and in 150 of this era. And he published a book which we call the Almagest in about 150 of the Common Era. The book was written in Greek. He's Claudius Ptolemy because Egypt was a Roman colony, of course, at that time. So Claudius is the Roman part of his name, Ptolemy the Greek part. And he was a Greek, and he thought and wrote in Greek. And his book has a Greek title. It's called the Mathematical Syntaxis, or the Mathematical Treatise. It was then changed to the Great Treatise, and then when adopted by the Arab cultures, it was changed to the Great Treatise in Arabic, which is Al-Magest, the greatest. And Magest, greatest, is where we get the English word majesty from. Now, of course, Ptolemy had no end of trouble because his model was such madness. But after Ptolemy, we come to more or less the Dark Ages. And the Dark Ages were, of course, quite dark, but they weren't completely dark. Knowledge was preserved during that era, and Christian thinkers did not really reject Greek thought or what was called pagan thought until about the Council of Nicaea, which I believe is about 325 CE, and at which point it became really anathema, and all of this material about a spherical earth and about epicycles, it all vanished and was removed from Christian thought. Even Augustine and all kinds of crazy ideas which we know of and make fun of today, like the earth had to be flat because were it round, people in the southern hemisphere would have to be standing on their heads. I've never understood that argument because if in the northern hemisphere you stand on your feet and in the southern hemisphere you'd have to stand on your head, at the equator you'd have to be lying down all the time. And I don't understand, and in some places you have to tilt. I mean, it just seems to be very strange, but that's what people thought. They also thought that the north part of the earth was higher than the southern part of the earth, so the rivers like the Nile, which flow from south to north, had to flow uphill, which is just madness. However, that's really what people believed. Even Augustine, who had spent a lot of time studying Plato and was obviously a very intelligent man, had problems with this discussion. Oh, here is a picture, by the way, of the Ptolemaic universe. There's the Earth in the middle, and I haven't put equants and so forth in, but there's the Earth in the middle. There's the Moon. There is Mercury with its little epicycle, and then Venus, etc., and the various planets with their revolving times, 29 and a half year period for Saturn, 11.9 years for Jupiter, a year for these two planets, and 1.9 years for Mars. Mercury rotates in about, makes an epicycle in about 88 days. Okay, now what Augustine wrote is pretty, you don't have to worry about what's really going on. All that you have to do is have faith that everything that we have, it arises from God. this is not a, an attitude which is particularly conducive to scientific research as we understand it. But he was quite moderate, whereas people in the Syrian church were very adamant in rejecting every possible thing that came from what they considered pagans. By the 8th century, however, 300-400 years after Augustine, people such as the Venerable Bede in English began to reproduce Greek ideas or Greek ideas kept creeping back in because people had Latin translations of some of the great works of the Greeks. Now, as I said yesterday, we don't have any originals from the Greeks. What we have are these copies that were made by people called the Neoplatonists between 300 and 600, and they were generally, and they would be in Latin, and people, but the knowledge of the Greek language had vanished from Western Europe. But by the time, say, of Charlemagne, who lived, 100 years after the Venerable Bede, the idea of the spherical earth was back and commonly accepted. The conquest of Alexander the Great had brought Greek knowledge and Greek astronomy into the Middle East, such that Greek terms in geometry, in astronomy, and in astrology, such as the Greek names for the signs of the zodiac, appear written in Sanskrit. The conquest of Persia by the Arabs in the 7th century brought them into contact with India, with Indian mathematicians, and with Greek philosophy. And so what we tend to call Arabic arithmetic or Arabic numerals really were, and the zero, really were invented by the Hindu peoples in India. As early as 773, there's a report of a man who came to Baghdad who knew trigonometry and who could predict the occurrence of eclipses. Greek philosophy in particular had been kept alive by people called the Nestorian Christians who had migrated to what is now Western Iran and who lived there, and that came back into the Arab cultures and was well developed under some of the famous Baghdad caliphs like Harun al-Rashid. Among really great Arab astronomers were people like al-Fargani. His name comes from the fact that he was born in the Fergana Valley, which is now in present-day Uzbekistan, and al-Khwarizmi, and I'm really fond of al-Khwarizmi because his name has come into the English language as algorithm, which was corrupted about 200 years ago into algorithm, and has become a term highly familiar to people who do any sort of computer programming. By the 11th and 12th centuries, Arab astronomy and mathematics had moved west, first to Egypt, then to the rest of North Africa, and finally to Spain. The great centers of learning in Toledo, in Cordoba, and in Seville supported many great names, both Muslim and Jewish. Unlike the Christian counterparts at the time, they had no animosity between science and their religion. They didn't make many advances from Ptolemy in terms of calculation, but unlike Ptolemy, they were very interested in a physical model of the universe, and the only one available to them was basically the crystalline spheres of Aristotle. But to account for the fact that the brightness of planets change from time to time, they made the spheres of differing thickness, and here is one by the astronomer Jagmini, who lived over the 13th and 14th centuries, and you can see what we have, these kind of lopsided spheres. Now, even when power transferred back to Christian hands in the 12th and 13th centuries, the influence of this stuff was felt. King Alfonso of Castile had astronomers, both Muslim and Jewish, at his court, and he had tables of the positions of the planets called the Alfonsine tables compiled. And These predicted eclipses, and they were widely used throughout the Middle Ages. They weren't, of course, really published until Mr. Gutenberg invented the printing press in movable type, but they existed all over. Copernicus had a copy, and they listed as they lasted as the principal set of tables for positions until replaced by Kepler in 1627. When Christian Europe finally came into contact with this Muslim culture in the 12th and 13th centuries, this influence was very serious. And pagan secular learning was no longer seen as a threat because the church had a lot of, was a very powerful outfit, and the fights were not particularly with Muslims, but the fights were between the Pope in one hand and the Holy Roman Empire in the north on the other hand. So when people began to get their hands on and be able to read Greek text, ancient Greek text, what resonated most with them were the works of Aristotle. And the greatest thinker of that time was Thomas Aquinas, now, of course, St. Thomas Aquinas. Aquinas lived only 49 years, 1225 to 1274. During that time, he wrote or dictated over 8 million words of theological insight, but much of which reads as if it were written by Aristotle. But he's got problems with Aristotelian thought. So that, for example, Aristotle said that the universe had always existed, but that, of course, is in conflict with the first words of Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And in addition, as I mentioned yesterday, there was this terrible problem about let there be a firmament made amidst the waters and let it divide the waters for the waters. And Aquinas's discussion and explanation of this is what makes people tend to laugh at the scholastics these days, as these Aristotelian Middle Age people were called. Because he says that Moses, who he said wrote the entire Old Testament, or the first five books thereof, Moses knew he was talking to ignorant people. And so he had to use words that ignorant people could understand. Now, ignorant people could understand earth and water, but they couldn't understand air. And so he just made up this explanation that you could put water up above the air. And, you know, he wiggled his way around that. Scripture stays unchanged, of course, but the writings of Aquinas and his fellow scholastics are full of this kind of deviation. Nonetheless, he has reintroduced Aristotelian thought to Europe, and that's very significant. And Aristotle becomes crucial to Christian theology. And the idea of a geocentric universe becomes crucial to Christian theology. And nowhere is this more evident than in the greatest work to survive the Middle Ages, Dante's Divine Comedy. He called it, of course, La Commedia, the comedy. But a century after his death, not a century after his death, because it was such a significant work, the writer Boccaccio said, oh, this comedy is divine, so he called the Divina Commedia, the Divine Comedy. In this, there is a perfect description of his journey through the 14th century universe. There's a spherical earth, and he descends through nine circles of hell, which perfectly mirror the nine celestial spheres above. Nine circles. Seven planets, Mercury, Venus, Moon, Sun, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. An eighth circle involving the stars, and a ninth circle, which had been introduced by the Muslim astronomers in order to account for the precession of the Earth's axis. Nine circles. At the center of the Earth, which is the center of the universe, was the devil and his various legions. If you rise up through the nine circles, you pass through purgatory and the terrestrial spheres of air and fire. Dante then journals with his guide Virgil through each of the celestial spheres until contemplating God's throne in the last sphere. It's a perfect description, and Dante was deeply, deeply interested in astronomy in his day. Aristotelian texts were studied with intense interest, and any consistencies of doctrine or proof were noticed and they were discussed. They were challenged, they weren't changed. However, it is because of these ideas that reason and rational thinking came back into a discussion of natural philosophy, as it was called. Now, it has become very common in our age to ridicule Aquinas and the Scholastics because they had these arguments about water and about how many angels could dance on the heads of pins, etc. But most of those arguments or the derision to the Scholastics were made by people who made the Renaissance, by the humanists of the Renaissance. And it's not 100% fair, because without them, we would not have human reason involved in solving the problems of nature. The great American philosopher Alfred North Whitehead has written the following: faith in the possibility of science generated antecedently to the development of modern scientific theory is an unconscious derivative from medieval theology. Now, I've skipped a whole bunch of stuff, so since I have 5 minutes or so, I'm going to put it back in. Aristotelian ideas of motion are very strange. He had this idea that in order to get an object in motion, you need to push it, but in order to keep it in motion, you need to keep pushing it. The idea of inertia that Newton developed, he's got no conception of. So that for an arrow, the bowstring gets the arrow into motion. But what keeps it in motion is the air. That is, the point of the arrow makes turbulences in the air, and these turbulences run back and push the arrow from the end. That's madness, but okay. Now, of course, therefore, for Aristotle, it would be impossible to have motion without air. But of course, there has to be air in Aristotle's universe until you get out into the celestial regions where there's just ether. And it's from this kind of thinking that we get the very famous phrase that nature abhors a vacuum. Nothing could be further from the truth. Most of our universe is empty space, is vacuum. And in physics, the vacuum is in fact the most exciting thing we have, because by quantum mechanics, particles can appear and disappear in the vacuum for short periods of time. It's a very exciting thing. Excuse me. Now, in the Middle Ages, there were two very fine thinkers in about the 15th century. There was because at that time, the University of Paris was the predominant center for intellectual life. And at the time, the two of the most important natural science thinkers were Jean Bouridon and Nicolas Oresme. And Oresme had the idea of what he, this is 1320 to 1382, was his lifespan. And he was particularly important because he invented a new theory called the impetus theory, that natural motion is motion is important relative to its surroundings, not in an absolute sense. That argument, which sounds very subtle, is the argument used by Galileo 300 years later when he said, if you are on a ship that is moving on a calm sea, and if you drop a knife from the top of the mast, its relative motion will put it at the bottom of the mast not behind the mast as the ship has moved forward during its time of fall. That's in fact incorrect. It will fall in front of the mast, but that's okay. We don't need to worry about that. In fact, it'll fall not only to the front, but a bit to the side, depending on what latitude on Earth you are. Never mind that. Scholastics like Oresme discuss the possibility of Earth's motion in discussing Aristotle's logic. And several of Copernicus's argument are borrowed from earlier and unacknowledged sources. Now, I think I will stop just in case anybody has any exciting questions. Tomorrow, I want to talk about Copernicus. And also a bit about astrology, just a little bit about astrology, which was tremendously important for centuries and then came to a dead stop, basically, among serious people with